your class in some cases.
If I can get everyone's attention, please. Today's Lunch and Learn is sponsored by the TAPS Throughput Committee. As you know, we're looking at issues on increasing throughput through the TAPS system. And we want to introduce some folks here that have a Lunch and Learn that are directly related to technical challenges that we'll have in the future. So I want to introduce from Heavy Oil Solutions, Mr. Jerry Meyer. Jerry.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you.
Appreciate it. Want to thank the special throughput committee on the TAPS challenge that you've got. And I'd like to introduce our team. This is Michelle Miller. She's part of the Heavy Oil Solutions. Heavy Oil Solutions was formed about a year ago in Fairbanks. I'm a 45-year resident of Fairbanks, so pretty well, and done a lot of work up on the North Slope in the early days. And then Steve Yarbrough here is our chief engineer, and he is the engineer that's developed this technology that we want to share with you today, which we think is going to, could be, if implemented, could be instrumental in actually stopping your decline in the TAPS pipeline.
I'll be closer to the mic.
Speak close to the mic.
Thank you.
Okay. Thank you. But anyway, the technology that Steve is going to be presenting to you, he's going to go into it in significant detail, and I think that it's very exciting, and it's something that we think that's could help the state of Alaska. And so, with that, I'd like to turn it over to Steve. But before I do that, his background and the technology that he developed is probably as a result of his unique background that he has. He's a chemist, he's also a process engineer, he has worked for the oil companies in his earlier career, and then he worked for the Hanford Plutonium Processing Facility, where he was in charge of 1,000 people for processing plutonium. He then moved from there to Los Alamos National Laboratory. And then one of the projects he worked on was worked on the team that that ended up stopping the spill, the oil flow on the BP platform. And so Steve participated in that, and so I'd like to, and he'll go through all of those things in his presentation. So that's, go ahead, Steve.
Okay, well, thank you, Jerry. Again, good afternoon. I'm Steve Yarbrough from Heavy Oil Solutions, and I just want to thank you for attending our Lunch and Learn. I really appreciate this opportunity to talk to you about a technology that we believe will increase the flow of oil in TAPS. And essentially what I want to do today is I want to talk a little bit first. I'm just going to talk briefly about the declining flow in the TAPS pipeline, but everybody, I'm not going to spend a lot of time on that. Then I'm going to talk a little bit about your vast unconventional oil reserves. Alaska is unique in the tremendous natural reserves you have, and we believe that this technology can help you responsibly develop the billions of barrels of unconventional oil that you have. I'd like to tell you a little bit about the technology itself. I'd like to show you its performance and what it can do. And then I'd like to wrap up with what I think is a summary of the benefits to Alaska as a result of this technology. So with that, just again, Jerry went into it, so I won't spend a lot of time, but Heavy Oil Solutions was formed to capitalize on this particular technology. Basically, I'm a current member of Los Alamos National Laboratory, so I've got to give you a little bit, I'll have to adjust the background a little bit. I have worked for Phillips Petroleum. I did work at the Hanford site in their atomic products at the plutonium facility. I spent the last 30 years or so at Los Alamos National Laboratory. I did run the plutonium facility there for several years, and then the last few years I've been a member of the Field Intelligence Element, which is a part of the DOE Office of Intelligence and Counterintelligence. Recently, though, been developing this as a part of that. So, Jerry, of course, has told you a little bit. He's been a businessman at Fairbanks for over 40 years, and he's our business manager. Myself, I have a PhD in chemical engineering, but please don't hold that against me, really. I park my cone head at the door when I come in, okay? So, again, where this came from was is in the mid-90s, we were looking at supercritical water to recover the radioactive waste in the underground waste tanks at Hanford. And so we looked at supercritical water oxidation to do that. As part of the BP oil spill, actually my role was incredibly minor. We were supporting the guys that were actually out there doing the hard work.
Steve, yeah. You should explain what supercritical water is.
Oh, thank you, I will. And supercritical water is actually just ordinary water, but it's past its critical point where it turns into a hot, dense gas, and that's at high temperatures and pressures, typically about 800 degrees Fahrenheit and about 4,000 to 5,000 pounds of pressure. So, and as a result of that, the BP, we were looking at the oil flowing down at those depths, and it turns out that the pressure at those depths was similar to the pressures we were working with the supercritical water work in the mid-90s. And so that began the seed of the idea to begin looking at how to use this to treat the heavy oil. And so here we are. And Michelle is our other partner, and she keeps us in line. She helps with the business strategy and the marketing, and basically keeps me in line when I start going off and using too much nerd speak. So that's let's talk a little bit about your vast heavy oil reserves. Alaska is rich. I think you have somewhere around 35 to billion barrels of heavy and viscous oil. And it's a real resource that, if properly developed, could increase the flow of oil in taps. The nice thing about that particular resource and what this map represents is that it's sitting where the current infrastructure for your conventional oil sits. So a lot of the infrastructure that was used for conventional oil could be leveraged if the heavy oil could be made to look like conventional oil, which this technology does. Again, we all understand that the flow of conventional oil in taps is declining. Depending on what you count as the rate, somewhere around maybe 5 to 6% a year. So we still have time, and they're still doing a lot of work in improving the production of conventional oil, but ultimately that's a problem that we'll need to face. And we want to responsibly develop these vast resources of unconventional oil. Now, what are the barriers? What is preventing us from getting this and using this unconventional oil? Well, essentially, one of the key traits is viscosity. And if you're familiar with what essentially all viscosity is, a measure of how thick it is. The heavy oil that you currently have is either viscous to heavy. And that means it's between, say, syrup and very, very thick honey. So coming out of the ground, even though there's production methods for getting it out of the ground that have been developed in Canada and in California and other places, once you get it to the surface, then you can't put it in the pipeline as is. You can't pump it unless you mix it with conventional oil or another solvent. But we're running out of conventional oil. So what we have is a way to reduce the viscosity and upgrade the value of the oil. So not only do you get a less viscous oil that now you can pump in the pipeline, but you also get a higher value oil because we remove the sulfur and the metallic impurities and increase the API so that you get more light distillates from the oil. So now, what is the solution? What is the technology? Supercritical water extraction and refining. And again, supercritical water is just ordinary water, but it's at high temperatures and pressures. And what it does is it's quite unique. When it gets up at those high temperatures and pressures, it ceases to behave like normal water. What it does is its capability to dissolve organics is tremendous. And so you can dissolve these heavy oils directly in the water, and then at those high temperatures and pressures, you can thermally crack these large molecules into smaller molecules, which are the lighter molecules that you want. It's the lighter oil. You also cleave off the sulfur, and you can reduce the acidity and remove the metallic impurities. So what you get is a very light, sweet crude as a result of that, and some gas that you can recycle. Plus the fact, because it runs at high temperatures and pressures, you get oil at a very high temperature, so you can put lots of heat content back into the pipeline. Also, you have a lot of waste heat there that you can reuse to either generate electricity or all kinds of things with it. So it's really a fascinating technology. Now, when you think supercritical water, you probably, your first is, what, what is that? It just sounds odd. But actually, supercritical water has been known for many, many years. In fact, the first instance of using supercritical water was in 1922 when a fellow named Benson patented the first supercritical water boiler. And the reason why they did that was because they were having lots of boiler accidents. Because regular water would have problems with forming bubbles and things, and they would have a boiler explosion. By going through the supercritical water phase, not only do you get an extremely high efficiency, but it's actually much safer. And that was the reason that he patented that particular boiler. It's also used for power generation. A lot of the utilities are going to supercritical water cycles now because of the efficiency. And it's used for waste oxidation. In fact, why we were using it back in the 90s was because it's so good at destroying organics. It's one of two technologies that is licensed by the Department of Defense to destroy chemical munitions. In fact, they're building a large plant in Alabama to destroy the last bits of the United States stockpile of chemical munitions with this technology. Ourselves, we've been working on this for the last 2.5 years, developing the process, optimizing it. And as I said earlier, the original idea was as a result of the BP Gulf disaster. And we've been working the last year specifically on running Alaskan oil, different samples of Alaskan oil. And I'll talk more about that in a moment. Now let's talk a little bit more about viscosity. This is really a key reason why your current heavy oil would be difficult to develop as is once you get it out of the ground. Essentially, and I know it's a little hard to see, but I may pass this around, but this is a sample of heavy oil from the North Slope. And I know you can't see it out in the audience, but I'll pass it around. You guys can see just how thick that is and how heavy. That's why you can't necessarily just get it out of the ground and pump it. You're going to have to dissolve it up in something or treat it in some fashion. Essentially, it's like heavy syrup or honey or maybe even peanut butter or vegetable shortening. So let me talk a little bit about the performance that we've been able to get with Alaskan oil. First, the North Slope sample heavy oil that's being passed around now is an API about 12.3. That's pretty heavy. What we did in our first test, and this was without any optimization at all, we got it up to 23.3, which is essentially this. So you can see, flows just like water. We also took out more than half of the sulfur. Your heavy oil is about 1.43%. Sweet crude is about 0.5. You know that a lot of the refineries are having difficulties because of the very, very low sulfur restrictions on transportation fuels. Well, we can take the sulfur out and produce a very sweet crude. That also reduces the corrosion in the pipeline. So, and that was without any optimization. That was just the what do we call our baseline process. We've also looked at refinery resids, bunker asphalt, where we've taken that up to essentially 44.6. And again, I know it's very difficult to see, but that oil that I can shake around like water started off like this. You can see. So this oil, 44.6, optimized for jet fuel production, started off. So we also looked at things like paraffin pig waste, storage tank bottoms, and then I just got some asphalt from Amazon.com just to see what we could do with it, and we turned it into about 29 to 30 API oil. So, and pig waste is interesting because it's the waxy solids that they get out of the pipeline. And that we turned into about 40, 41 API oil. So again, just to give you an example of what we're able to do. This just gives you an idea of the sulfur, and sulfur is very key to refiners because sulfur is a real problem when they have to take it out. It's very expensive and it's very energy intensive. We were able to reduce the sulfur in the North Slope heavy oil by 60%. Now the refinery resid, we were very careful with that because they want to maximize the volume. So we kind of just lightly toasted it. We didn't really go after it hard so that we could keep, but we took it down to about what the current pipeline is. Paraffin pig waste was great. You wouldn't believe it, but pig waste? I mean, you'd think, my gosh, you know, that'd be hard stuff to work with. It's beautiful. It's so easy to run, and it gives you such nice oil because it already comes in as paraffins, and they crack very nicely. Plus, the sulfur was reduced dramatically. And then storage tank bottoms, which are essentially the sledges you get out of the bottom of this, we were able to take that by over half, the sulfur over half, and make, again, a good quality oil. I'll show you some pictures. This is just, the North Slope heavy oil that's going around. Again, we got that up to essentially, it's 23.3, which is a good oil. This is the North Slope paraffin, the pig waste. And what I want you to note in the picture up there, and it's hard to see because of the lights, but how clear the water is. Because our process is environmentally benign. We use water with some commercially available additives that are not environmental problems. And at the high temperatures and pressures, what we can do is when we recycle the water, and then we can take the water and by turning up the oxygen a little bit, we can burn off any of the residual organics and have a very clean water stream. So it's very environmentally benign. These are the tank bottoms, and what I want to point out here, and again it may be hard to see in the picture, is the sand at the bottom, because what you get is all the corrosion products and the junk. And part of the problems with treating the tank bottoms now when they scrape them out is getting the solids out. But once you go through this process, the solids settle very easily. In fact, I didn't bring a sample of that, but you shake that up and they settle within about 10 to 15 seconds. So one of the problems, they have to use big centrifuges and things now to treat the bottoms to get the sand particles out. And then this is just asphalt that I got off the net. And again, we turned it into API 32 oil, which is the quality of oil you currently have flowing in taps right now. And that started off as asphalt that I got just to test the system from, of all places, Amazon.com, which is, you can get just about anything from Amazon these days, amazingly enough. I mean, you know, maybe we buy a couple more rolls of that and we can get the pipeline flow up. Who knows? You know, I mean, they'd sell it to us cheap. And this is bunker fuel, and you can see the consistency. It's like taffy. I don't know if you guys remember taffy poles and everything. It's just like taffy. Again, because we were trying in this one, we were looking to optimize the output of light distillates. And let me explain why. Because rather than just look at how do we get flow in the pipeline up, what we want to do is look at what's the strategic right answer, which is how does increasing the flow in the pipeline increase the value across the entire petroleum system? So not only do we get the flow in the pipeline up, which helps with the corrosion, which increases the heat. By increasing the heat content and the quality of the oil also helps the refineries. Now the refineries use less energy because they have a better oil. They don't have to handle the extra sulfur. They can optimize the production of products that Alaska needs, like jet fuel and the light distillates. And so you maximize the value across the entire value chain. By carefully thinking how you're going to solve the flow problem, you can solve a variety of problems and increase the value for the whole thing in Alaska. Just a little bit about, though, development timeframes and everything. When you look at the rate of decline in the pipeline now, and then how you would begin to develop these heavy oil fields, what we think in terms of a strategy would be to go after the viscous oil first. And the viscous oil is APIs around 18. So again, you're looking at something kind of like syrup. And there's already an infrastructure. There's already development and production going on. It's beginning to climb. I don't know. It's probably somewhere in the 20,000 barrels per day or something like that. But we think strategically that would be a good place to start. Upgrade that to a lighter oil, so now that they don't have to do the blending and everything they do now, which is just something refineries have to fool with. And when you think about it, again, you take a really good product and a not so good product, and you blend them and make a mediocre product. Well, what we'd like to do is have a good product and an even better product to make the best product we can. Now that gives you time to begin to develop the infrastructure in heavy oil. So you develop the technology, upgrade the value of the viscous oil, get your infrastructure going for the heavy oil, and then apply this so that you have a nice smooth transition to continually increase the flow in the pipeline. Now, what are some of the nuts and bolts about what we'd like to do to go about actually beginning to develop this? Well, the chemistry clearly works, so the process works. So what we need to do is take the commercialization step and prove that it's commercially viable. What we'd like to do is we've talked to the Fairbanks Pipeline Training Center. They've got lots of good infrastructure there for developing pilot plants. Not only do they have the large buildings, but they also have the people that can be a part of developing this in terms of operators, mechanics, people like that. This just gives you kind of a conceptual view of what the development of the pilot plant would look like sitting at the Pipeline Training Center. They fit in about two transportainers with about three trucks to move product to and from and hold the water. So it's actually pretty compact. This is a flowchart. What I want to illustrate here is not so much the technology. Again, I'm trying to avoid a lot of nerd speak. But in this case, what I want to do is highlight some points. First off, oftentimes when you're developing technology, as I've done for the last 30 years, what Mother Nature tends to really slap you in the face with the hard, cold facts, and they're never what you want. But in this case, Mother Nature gave us a little kiss on the cheek in that when we thermally crack the soil, it goes up in volume. So you actually get more volume out than you put in. So you get more volume of a higher quality oil. So that just never happens. So you take advantage of it. It's very efficient with water because we recycle all the water. In fact, you want to recycle the water because you're taking advantage of the heat integration. And it produces very high quality heat that we can use in a variety of different ways. When you have heat at those temperatures, you can do a lot with it. I mean, you can reuse it, you can put it in the pipeline, you can generate electricity, you can do all kinds of things. And we're environmentally clean. Again, if this technology can be used to clean up chemical munitions, it can clean up this kind of material, and so that you have a very, very lean and low waste stream. The other thing that I want to emphasize is even though it sounds new, it's a new technology, actually it's based on a lot of commercial knowledge. The 5 barrel per day that we're talking about in terms of a pilot, all that uses off-the-shelf equipment. There's nothing there that's unique or strange or different or has to be specially designed. Everything there, the heat exchangers, the pumps, the piping, the control system, everything is what you would normally use in a standard petrochemical plant. In fact, even the temperatures and pressures are not that far away what they typically handle in a refinery. So we're not talking about anything here that's particularly super dangerous or new or unique. This is all commercially available equipment that you can buy essentially off the shelf. This just gives you an idea of how compact the process itself is. This, like a 25 barrel per day unit, would easily fit in one of these transportainers with room left over. So that just gives you an idea of the compactness. And things that are compact are relatively simple because we don't have any special mixers or anything like that. Again, we're just using the most moving parts we have are in the pumps that we would use and the valves. So it uses conventional equipment, and what that does is that helps us control the costs and the maintenance. Now let me talk a little bit about the revenue. And again, I don't want to get into this other than the fact that if you can see, these are big numbers. And why are they big? Because typically heavy oil, and it's a little different in Alaska, but when you look at, say, California or globally, heavy oil like this sells for about $20 cheaper than conventional oil because it's so much harder to refine and you get fewer distillates. Well, if you upgrade it and you get that extra $20, $25 a barrel for the oil and you're able to do it for a cost that's within that range so you keep your production costs low, you're making $15 more a barrel, $20 more a barrel, and your pumping costs go down in your pipeline, your refining costs go down because your energy use is less. So you can see that when you begin to add that up over some amount of oil recovered, and again, we don't know how much oil is potentially recoverable, but say in the 2 to 4 to 6 billion barrels of oil range, you're looking at some incredibly large numbers. And Alaska benefits from this revenue. So let me conclude. Let me wrap it all up. I've talked a little bit about our background, talked a little bit about the problem itself, a technical solution to the problem, the performance of that technology and how it applies, and now I'd just like to bring it all together and what I believe it can do for the state of Alaska. I mean, you guys have control of an enormous natural resource. I mean, that's, if you look at the U.S. Oil reserves, you guys are number two in the U.S. in terms of heavy oil holdings, California being number one. If you understand California's oil industry, it's totally based on heavy oil, and it's quite robust. You guys are number two with somewhere in the order of 30 billion barrels of oil available. All you need is a technology to unlock that potential for the state. Increase the flow of oil in the pipeline with high quality crude oil. So we believe that even that this technology can do be that key that can unlock that potential, increase the flow, which then provides revenue and then the jobs that go along with that revenue. So I've tried to keep the engineering talk down, even though we'll talk a little more engineering later. But with that, I'd like to conclude and see if there are any questions that I can answer. Anything that... Yes, sir.
Yeah, thank you.
So, are there challenges?
Does the heavy oil or viscous oil present challenges to the oil companies to actually bring it to the surface where you could do this?
It does, but that's where we're fortunate in one regard. Canada and California both having pretty robust. In fact, Canada's oil industry is particularly difficult because a lot of it is almost solid underground. And they've had 30 or 40 years of experience now developing different techniques to get the heavy oil out. And so, for example, CHOPS, I think you've heard of CHOPS, cold heavy oil production with sand is something that BP has experimented with and actually had, other than they've had some technical problems, because anytime you take it from Canada to a different place, but they've actually had very good success, you know, up to 600 barrels per day. And for heavy oil, well, that's tremendous. And so there are technologies that are already in use at very large scales that I think Alaska can take and adapt for these oil fields. Yes, sir.
Excuse me, not a pejorative question.
Uh-oh.
Are, at the end of the day, are you going to suggest that the state help finance this?
Yes.
And then the follow-on question, why aren't the major oil companies that have the heavy oil, BP for instance, lined up outside the door to finance you?
Well, we haven't really approached them. And the reason why is because clearly BP will have BP's own interests at heart, as they should, being a company. But the technology itself has benefit across a lot of different parts of the oil chain. And I think Alaska as a state or as an entity would be more interested in developing that across that whole spectrum as opposed to staying very focused on a narrow segment, because that would bring the most benefit to Alaska. And so we felt like that was the best route to go.
Thank you.
Yes, sir.
I just wondered if there are any technologies that consider subsurface treatment to eliminate the difficulty of extraction in the first place.
It's been a lot of work on trying to do different. In fact, there was a mobile did a lot of work back in the late 70s, early 80s to try to use supercritical water subsurface. The problem that they had was controlling the conditions in the reservoir proved so difficult that they couldn't reliably repeat the conditions that they needed. So the production, it was very costly for them to try to control, because you have this large reservoir that's difficult to completely characterize. And so the cost and the difficulty proved so hard that they stopped. Mm-hmm. On the surface, if we use already other proven technologies to get the well to the surface, and then we do this at the surface, we can control it very precisely. And then you can get a very, very good product or a variety of different products from that.
Thank you.
Yes, sir.
Thank you. Is this in commercial usage anywhere, this process for developing oil? Question one. And question two is, how much per barrel would this add to the cost?
Excellent questions. No, it's not being used commercially anywhere. There are competing technologies, but this particular technology is not being used commercially anywhere, at least that I'm aware of. And it depends on the throughput, but if once you get up to about 1,000 barrels per day, and that 1,000 to 1,500 barrels per day, it adds about $5 to the cost, production cost per barrel. And what it does is, you know, at 5 barrels per day, it's fairly high, it's about 10, but as you get up to about 1,500, it flattens out, and then it's about 5 from then on out. Yes, sir.
It's along that same line. Mm-hmm. You know, under your model, what do you anticipate using to heat your water with? Because that would seem to be part of the question on the economics of the transfer of energy, right?
Yeah. See, that's what's so cool about this. Heavy oil has a huge amount of energy in it. 54,000 kilojoules. It's big. So what we do is we burn a small portion, a small fraction of heavy oil inside the reactor itself. And what that does is it does a couple of things for you. One is it heats evenly across the reactor. So you have a little furnace, you get things up to temperature so you can start the reaction. And you burn a small portion of it. But what that also does is the partial oxidation of the oil provides some of the hydrogen then that you need as a reagent to upgrade the oil. So not only do you get the heat from that, but you get a reagent generated in situ, so you don't have to have big doers of hydrogen or other things to generate like you would in a refinery. It also allows you to control it very carefully. You can get very tight control of the temperature that way. So it's actually really, really neat the way that all works together, and because you get more volume as a result of the cracking, so you, pretty much what you put in, you get out. So it's really cool.
What I take it is you control it by the flow of water.
Control it. What you do is you can control the amount of oxidant, like air or oxygen, that you meter in, and that controls the rate of oxidation in the furnace, which controls the generation of heat.
Just as you're answering these, could you go back to the process flow diagram?
Sure.
Might help folks understand.
Mm-hmm. Okay. See, what you can see is here, just for a 20,000 barrel per day process, you get about an extra 300 barrels per day out. And you probably, again, depending on what the impurities are in the feed, so that might change it slightly, you about 2,000 barrels per day out of the 20,000 would be blowdown that you would treat, because it's going to have some of the metals and things like that, the junk that comes in. So you'll make up about 20,000 barrels per day. But the vast majority will be recycling inside the process. So you'll be able to recover the pressure and the heat, both. So you can be very, very efficient with the process and keep your overall energy use fairly low. Yes, sir.
So I don't think it's difficult to analyze on a smaller scale, but can the generating capacity offset the cost per barrel? Have you calculated?
Perhaps
that offset.
That we think there are going to be several offsetting things. For example, you make some fairly high quality gas that will offset. Plus, we think we can generate electricity fairly efficiently that could offset some of the cost of the energy.
The waste heat.
Yes, sir. In fact, there's a couple of corporations right now that make. Again, what we'd like to do is take kind of a Lego block approach, where you build this in modules. So depending on how much flow you need, you just line up the modules. So now you can control your costs and your fabrication very efficiently. And there's a couple of companies that make essentially skid-mounted electrical generating units, turbines, that work with the kind of steam and water that we'll have. So you can essentially plug them right in and plumb them in, start it up, and then plug it into your power system. Oh, I'm sorry.
Yeah. So BP just announced they were stopping their CHOPS program. Mm-hmm. Do you know, in Alaska, is the problem more the extraction problem, getting it out of the ground, or is the problem more of increasing the API?
Well, you've got, you know, BP took a well-known technology and applied it. So there was a lot of industrial background there. But the way that they get it into the pipeline is they have to blend with conventional oil. In fact, a couple of I know BP presentations talked about the urgency to try to get heavy oil development going fast enough to take advantage of the dwindling conventional oil. And see, that's the problem. You're still dependent on conventional oil. This, you're no longer dependent on conventional oil. You can develop these heavy oil fields independent of that and have the flow. Now you're not having to blend. You're actually putting more good oil into the pipeline. And that's the current problem. And that's why they were talking about a sense of urgency, because as the oil gets heavier, it takes more and more conventional oil to blend with it to be able to pump it. So if you want that investment in those, in that heavy oil extraction to be used, to be leveraged, you really need a technology that separates you from conventional oil production.
And it doesn't use the process facilities either.
Yeah.
The existing process facilities.
I didn't hear that.
Oh, Jerry?
No, go ahead.
He just said that you can use the existing, what they already have, existing process facilities and everything, you know. So you can leverage off a lot of the infrastructure that's already in place.
There's a question in the audience.
Oh, yes, sir.
So Steve, my organic chemistry is a little old, but my impression was you seem to be doing better and better as you got down into some of the higher, longer hydrocarbon chains. What if we kept it on going? What about coal? Could you also separate out in something different than maybe complete gasification of coal, but help fill the pipeline?
Interesting that you ask. In fact, I really appreciate that question. We've actually just recently looked at that issue. We've got some, because they're in the Four Corners area, we have a large quantity of coal, San Juan coal. I know Alaska has huge deposits of coal. We were able to get our hands on some Alaska coal. And what's interesting about Alaska coal is it's high in moisture. What we were able to do, and it took several runs, but what we were able to do is convert over 90% of the carbon in the Alaska coal to oil. That translates into over 2 barrels of oil per ton.
So for example, if a certain offshore deposit comes on shore with a pipeline going by the Lisburn coal fields, which are 300 years of the planet's coal's energy supply, it would be an interesting subset to add to and continue that pipeline on into the next few hundred years.
See, what's interesting about our approach as opposed to a conventional gasification and Fischer Tropsch type approach is that there you have to put a lot of energy in to gasify, and you have to get the gas right, you have to scrub out the carbon dioxide, and then you run it over a catalyst bed, and you got to regenerate your catalyst, and depending on the catalyst, you may get a very narrow distillate off that, like diesel or gasoline. We dissolve the carbon out, and then we upgrade that, because now that looks like a heavy oil, and we upgrade that to where now you get the combination, so now you can get the suite of light distillates that you need off the column. So it's a different approach, and it very preliminary. So there's still coal is a tough problem because of all the inerts that come along with it. But at least the very preliminary results that we've had were very encouraging. We got something similar with the San Juan coal. We got over 90% of the carbon, and so that translates into over 2 barrels of oil per ton. So when you look at 8,800 BTU coal, average US $11-$12 a ton. and then two over two barrels of $90 per barrel. You can see how the value chain works there. It's pretty cool. So excellent question. Excellent question.
Steve?
Yes, sir.
Three quick questions. I've been told that CO2 is very good for lifting heavy oil. Mm-hmm. Is that true?
I would assume so. I'm not an expert in that area, but I do know that CO2 flooding in medium, not heavy, but in medium oil reservoirs is quite well.
Second question, kind of a smart aleck question, but from your conversation, it looks like you violated both the first and second laws of thermodynamics. Mm-hmm. You're getting something for nothing?
It looks that way, doesn't it?
Yes.
But you're burning part of the oil, so you are having to burn a portion of it to get what you need.
But you're expanding it.
Right. So, and here's how it works. On a mass basis, you have less mass, but on a volume basis, you have more volume. So you burn a portion of the mass to get the energy you need to drive the process. But because you're taking a very high density and you're turning it into a low density, like taking you take a block of plastic.
I got it.
Yep, and so that's how you get the volume.
So how much money do you want?
Well, I wasn't supposed to talk about that.
Okay, thank you.
But I appreciate it, sir.
So, I assume this process would work on natural gas as well. Have you ever looked into?
We haven't done anything with natural gas, but that's an interesting question. But it does work on viscous, heavy solids, asphalt. Anything that you got to tear up, we can do a good job with.
Chairman, I know you have to go, but
yes, sir.
Last question. I know that getting our oil out of the ground is going to be similar to the coal problem. Probably the purest bitumen that we know of is over in Canada. Have you had a look at that on separation?
We haven't had the opportunity yet.
I think for us, we have the in situ problem of trying to get it up. So, if your feedstock can't get up there, then you can't work on it.
That's true, but we're betting that because Canada's had such success, California, all their heavy oil is a little heavier. It's about API 8 to 10, and it's at a depth of about 2,000 to 3,000 feet. So they've got a robust oil industry. So there's a lot of work out there getting it out of there.
Will you be around for questions? I know there's these people are just raring to get back to work.
Yes.
Fascinating process.
Thank you for having me.
Exciting to
really
see Alaskans working
Thank
on
you
some solutions. And you'll be around afterwards for questions, right?
Yeah. Okay.